Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, and this is episode number 63, and we're going to talk about The Case of the Missing Servant by Tarquin Hall.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, I like on the cover of my book, it says, Meet Vish Puri, India's most private investigator. I'm pretty sure it
private,
says it in that accent,
private, yeah.
Too.
Yeah, this was a fun book. This was a fun book. It's something that I never would have read, but I'm glad I did. It's neat.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's just something that I never would have looked at and said, hey, I should read that. But it's really a look at India. Mm-hmm. That I really enjoyed it. It was not heavy. It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, and in a sense, it could almost be called a cozy mystery, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the subject matter is serious enough that it kind of takes it out of that realm to me, somewhat.
Okay, so cozy mystery is actually like a subgenre?
Yeah, a cozy is, I don't know, you know, two sisters investigating mysteries and baking cookies in between while they talk about, you know, or knitting in their yarn shop while, you know, someone's killed and they have to figure it out and that kind of thing. That's a cozy.
I see.
You know, you've kind of taken into a little world that's kind of cozy.
Yeah, yeah.
I think some people would have said Miss Marple might have been the first cozies, but I never thought of Miss Marple being that way, any of those stories.
Oh. Gotcha, gotcha.
And this one I came across because the first one of this use of a mystery to investigate a new world that I came across, and there probably are previous ones, but The Number One Ladies Detective Agency by Alexandra McCall Smith, which we could read sometime. And that one, because it's a lady who set up in Africa, I can't remember the country, I'm so sorry, her own detective agency, you're seeing into that culture as she investigates. And so when I came across this, I said, oh, it's the same sort of thing. You get to see the culture through the native eyes.
Yeah. That's one of the things I like about those James Lee Burke novels.
Yeah.
Is New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, experiencing New Orleans that way. And
those are definitely not cozy.
Those are not cozy. Those are heavy.
Those are gritty.
Yeah, gritty, right.
Yes. But yeah, exactly. That's that kind of like a travelogue / mystery.
I guess in those books, he ends up in Montana. In fact, I remember one of them that I read, he ends up in Montana. And
yeah,
it's
the
kind
one
of
we talked about.
Yeah, okay. And then that's interesting too. And I think he wrote a series of books with the character in Montana.
Ah.
Yeah, not the same guy.
He must have enjoyed the research.
Yeah, he must split his time in between those two places.
Well, what I enjoy about this one is that the detective, Vish Puri, if I'm saying it right, he is evidently, he's very Punjabi. I don't know. That's what comments seem to say. And he has more than one case going on at a time. And he also is not just a lone wolf, Sherlock Holmes type, brilliant guy. It's not that he's not clever. He's very clever. But he's got a whole bunch of people working for him. He's got a real working detective agency. Mm-hmm. And every time you turned around, even though he seemed to almost be a figure of fun, because he's struggling with his weight, his wife doesn't want him to eat, you know, the fried samosas and that kind of thing, and the doctor's always on his case. But that just kind of makes him human because he has a very good understanding of human nature. And he's constantly looked up to, actually, when you get the slight view into the people like his driver and people like that. So I really enjoyed that. So you see him on this one big case. And then you see the other peripheral cases, and then you see India, and also the court system as he goes in and out dealing with everything.
Yeah, and all that was really interesting. You know, those people that work for him are somehow kind of like a lower caste or something. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't use their real names. He gives them all nicknames, so we need to come up with nicknames.
Oh, I know.
Because, that was really funny. Yeah.
What would our nicknames? We'll have to think about that, because I just loved that I'd be going, Face Cream.
Yeah.
That was the woman who would go undercover for him.
Yeah, and his driver was named Handbrake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I almost got the feeling that the nickname was also an Indian thing,
uh-huh,
or a Punjabi thing.
Yeah, a Punjabi thing. It said that. I don't have it in front of me,
right?
That quote, but it said because he's Punjabi, he doesn't use, you know, which is something, you know, I don't fully understand, but yeah, it's just one of those details that's really interesting, is because he's Punjabi, the way it was stated was like, you know, obviously he doesn't use people's real names. He gave yeah, everybody a nickname, you know, so.
Well, and he has his own nickname, Chubby,
mm-hmm,
yeah, that everyone calls him. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if his wife has one, probably. I just don't remember at this moment.
Yeah, she did. It was like Rami or something like that.
Yeah.
Rumby. Yeah. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was really interesting. And yeah, the whole caste system comes up all the time in here, and you know,
this book especially.
Yeah, and it was neat. He says, "I have this one thing: Hindu society." Okay, the Marathi poet Govindraj. How did he put it? Hindu society is made up of men who bow their heads to the kicks from above, and who simultaneously give a kick below.
Ooh.
And yeah, that's in chapter 18. So he's dealing with the people who have hired him, who are like above him.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the kicks he's getting from above. And then he gives kicks below to all these people who he's given these nicknames to. They all work for him. And
but he never treats them as if they're inferior.
No,
they're just,
he doesn't
treat
them badly.
You should treat them as employees, and he's very specific about what he wants.
Exactly.
And I guess I should say that most of his work comes from screening prospective marriage partners. You know, that used to be handled by the family, mm-hmm, because they would do arranged marriages. But these days, the families are having to deal with, these people who fall in love and then, or answer ads in the paper.
Yeah, and that was another.
They have to be investigated.
Yeah. That was another really interesting thing about what was going on in this book was, you know, we're seeing this Indian society, but it's an Indian society that's in change, just like ours is in change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we complain, you know, I do, often about how, you know, things aren't going right in the country often.
Right.
Okay. Because of a lot of cultural things. And
right,
they're experiencing the same thing in India. But in India, it's even more pronounced because, you know, normally there would be, you know, if someone wanted to marry someone else, they would actually, it was described in the book that they would go and inquire about this. Like if you had a daughter and this guy wanted to marry her, you could inquire to his family and say, you know, hey, you know, just try and find out things about him.
Yeah. Is he a gambler? Is he a womanizer?
Exactly.
Wait, is he okay guy?
Is he going to be okay? Right. Is he going to be someone I want my daughter to marry?
Right.
And, but now because of the way that the culture is going, that part of their society is getting whittled down. So a lot of times, you know, they're marrying without this knowledge, and you know, things don't go right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, children out of wedlock and things like that are becoming more common.
Yeah.
So so Vishpuri's main job is, you know, a rich person will come and say, hey, my daughter's about to get married. I need to know everything I can about this guy. And so that's what he does, is he goes out and he finds out.
Yeah, and his team of operatives will throw out all these lures once they kind of have an idea, they'll to get pictures and all that sort of thing. And then the main case is him investigating a very prominent public litigator who actually came to him in the first place and said, you know, there's starting to be whispers about this maid who's missing. And I don't know, these people, they come and they go, my wife handles it, but can you look into it? And while he's looking into it, the guy runs into a very up-and-coming policeman who's decided, hey, you know what? I can make my reputation on this.
Mm-hmm.
So he's pushing the case ahead, and the truth is there, but it's not easy to find because there's a house full of servants. There's the wife who is like the most grasping social person ever, you know?
Yeah.
One of the things that impressed me was in order to get his operative into the household as a servant, he has a call center set up. Vishpuri has a call center set up so that this woman just sits there and she knits in between and she answers the phone on different lines as different people for whoever's calling to check on something. And I thought, man, this guy, if I needed more proof that he is not small time, he's thought of everything. And it showed how grasping the wife was, as a matter of fact, because when she calls, she thinks this is the woman who, from a prominent family, who hired the maid before. And she gives her a good reference. And then the wife's like, oh, are you ever in our part of town? You ought to have dinner with us sometime. And so her social climbing chance to somebody she never even met.
Yeah, yeah. I love those details. He has like 15 lines going in, 15 phone lines coming into his place, and only six of them are for normal day to day stuff. And the other ones have all these other phone numbers attached where they'll, you know, depending on what phone rings, this lady will answer it and say, you know, this company.
Yes. And then she logs it, calls him and says, so and so called. So he knows what's going on.
Right. Because he's got, you know, he doesn't work on one case at a time. You said this before. He works on several. Mm-hmm. So, he's counting on the smarts of all these other people. And, and they all come through. It's neat.
And also, it's a nice touch that his driver is fairly new. He's very honored to have this good, steady job. And he's also really appreciating Vishpuri's intelligence and the clever way he finds things out because Vishpuri's almost training him.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll see a few of these conversations where that lets you see how he thinks and how he works. And then at the same time, I don't want to give – well, I guess we always assume now that you guys have read this book, but there's a murder attempt made on his life. And I'd forgotten that when I'm rereading the book, and I'm like, oh my gosh, yes. And what I had really forgotten is when he's recovered, they're going to look for the person, they've called the police. The police have gone. He goes down, he opens up a case file and goes, okay, well, that's number 12. Let's see. Someone tried to poison me once. And I'm like, holy moly, you do the job, I guess, if you get that many people mad at you.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the neatest parts about this book was his mom, and his mom got involved when he got shot at. So he's like, well, you know, I don't really have time to pursue that right now. I've got this other stuff going on, and it is number 12. And she's like, no. So she takes it upon herself to go investigate this. Oh, it was something.
Yeah, well, because he keeps telling her, he's like, Mommy G, don't you go looking into this. I told you before. And she's like, oh, no, I would never.
Yeah.
I'd not do this, son. And, you know, and then, of course, the minute his back is turned.
Oh, yeah.
She comes to stay with them then because she's got to take care of her son. And they're all like, oh, great. You know, not that they don't love her, but here's one more complication. And then the funny thing is, so you see her investigation going on, and she is doing the same stuff he does. And so you see, she's also got that native cleverness that has been honed to a fine point by Indian society.
Right, right. Yeah, she's plenty, you know, when you first meet her, you're thinking, oh boy, you know,
right,
this is going to be, you know, total incompetence, people tripping over each other, you know, and it turns out she is really competent. She knows exactly what she's doing, and she's funny. Her manners, there was a part in the book where he had to try to get into a courtroom and he couldn't. And she's like, oh, let me deal with this.
Yeah, you're right. What's your money for? I'll take care of you.
And she did.
He's like, okay.
She did. She went right in. It was like no problem.
Right, so, exactly. Yeah,
very cool. But, you know, it was all this societal stuff. You know, she could where he couldn't. You know, because of, you know, she was a girl or, you know, a female and all that stuff and a mom. And she was able to use all that. And it was neat. Really, really terrific.
Well, yeah. And even I found this one part that I had marked. He's got these people of all varying parts of society themselves. For instance, Mrs. Dougal, I guess is how you say the name. She actually was a spy for the Indian government. Her husband and her kids never knew it. She's retired. But she's kind of bored, too. So she'll do freelance jobs, posing as his wife when he needs to get into a party and investigate stuff. I mean, he's got... And I guess the reason this constantly surprised me was that he himself, he's not exactly comic, but he is played with a light touch, you know?
Yep, yep.
A very homey kind of touch, I suppose. He likes to tend his chili peppers on the roof and... He likes to, you know, he's always sneaking samosas and that kind of thing because, and I can't get a grease spot on my suit. My wife will know and she'll get so mad at me, you know. So he even talks to the doctor he goes to see, who's the one who's told him to lose weight, into giving him biscuits with his tea, cookies, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's the interesting part of the actual missing servant.
Yeah, but, and the mystery was interesting, too. It's like, you know, the two pieces to this book were both interesting to me. I really loved the Indian experience, but the mystery was good, too. You know, so it's a really good book, both halves of it. Satisfying mystery.
I felt so, too, because when I got close to the end of rereading this, or about halfway through, I suddenly went... Oh, wait a minute. From various things I was seeing, I went, that's right. That was this person. But I remember the first time I didn't know. And that mystery is used to take you into a completely different part of India. And it's telling, I think, of India's growth struggles is what this author is partly wanting to show you, that here's a part of India that's poverty stricken and just so hopeless. And the court system is another thing he's constantly lambasting. And at one point they mentioned Bleak House.
Yeah.
I went, oh, we've prepared for it.
Yeah. I have that highlighted because I laughed because we read Bleak House in a previous episode. But it says, Puri nodded knowingly. He knew what a long drawn out court case did to a family. The similarities between the Indian legal system and the Court of Chancery as described in Dickens's Bleak House were startling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, neat. See, so now that's why we read Bleak House, so we could read this.
Obviously.
And it would be have that added depth to it.
It's all part of a master plan that we don't know about.
I love it. Yeah.
But I also liked his... In a sense, it was his crusading spirit. He wanted to see right done and solve his cases. And he was very proud of being Indian. And the fact that this long ago Indian, was it a judge? I had this marked. Was the one who, way before Sherlock Holmes, had, you know, the fictional character, as he's always reminding everyone, that Chanakya, in 300 BC, had come up with all these techniques of deduction, as he will teach in these classes that he lectures at, too. He's a very busy guy.
Yeah.
But the author is pointing out all the places where India is struggling, and some places where they're deliberately, staying behind so that they can keep enough people employed. They're struggling with juggling a lot of factors. Like the big place with all the typewriters, they have all this paperwork, and they said, but they have to keep all these typists employed too, so there's no word processor ever allowed in there. You must have it typed.
Yep Yeah, for sure. And the you know, the whole theme of this, you know, change coming in, I highlighted something that I thought was really interesting. I just have this written in, so I'm not sure who's speaking, but he says, nowadays, he'd concluded, a man can fly from one end of the planet to another in a few hours only. Achievements in science are at a maximum. But still, there is more mischief going on than ever before, especially in overpopulated cities like Delhi. Puri believed that this was because the world was still passing through Kali Yuga, the age of Kali, a time of debauchery and moral breakdown. More and more, people's moral compass is turning 180 degrees, so you must be vigilant. Remember what Krishna told Arjuna at the Battle of Kurukshetra. The discharge of one's moral duty supersedes all other pursuits, whether spiritual or material. That was interesting. That's on page 105.
Okay. That, well, and, you know, what can I say but amen?
I mean, not
Kali, but the rest of it is all too familiar.
Yeah, it is all too familiar. And it's interesting. It just seems to be such a, you know, when you look at Indian society as presented in this book and how it's being changed from the outside, mm-hmm. it's more obvious, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a greater shift for them than it was for us. You know, we just seem to be just slowly changing constantly, whereas, you know, these folks are, it's almost like a jarring quick change for them.
Well, I feel like it's going on faster and faster for us. It just began sooner.
Yeah, maybe so.
I think that's probably why everybody feels so unsettled. And maybe I mentioned this before. I can't remember. Sorry, I'm banging my book around. Mm. That I was, I rarely listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History anymore because they've gotten so long, or the series are so long. I really enjoyed his shorter episodes at the beginning, but I was listening to the very beginning of a recent one, and he was talking about two different ages, maybe, for example, the Dark Ages and the Renaissance or something. And he said, you know, this was a period between those times, but those people didn't call it that. They didn't have those names. We gave it those names. And he said what they knew is they were unhappy. Everything was changing. They didn't know how to grasp it. They weren't making enough. The things were all different than they used to be. And it left everyone very unsettled. And he said that's the sign of a change between two eras. And he said, does this sound familiar? I think we're going through one of these right now. Later they'll call it something. But we're just suffering through it. And in one way, it made me recognize that what he was saying was true, because I'm of an age where I can look back and go, wow, everything was different when I was growing up, even though that was the 60s and 70s. But there was this common understanding, really, of how you lived, and people might want different kinds of change, but there wasn't all this outward shouting about it. And kind of feeling like maybe somebody despises you because you don't think the way they do. Hmm. And then now, of course, it feels very chaotic, kind of as he's expressing in this book. And so I thought, oh, yeah. So I liked having that identified. It kind of helped me, I don't know, maybe labeling things made me feel good. It helped me put it in perspective. And on the other hand, it kind of made me sad.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't know. You never know what you're heading into.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's clearly making a lot of people sad. You know, mm-hmm. I think that if you had to pick a prevailing theme of science fiction right now, you'd have to say pessimism.
Right.
You know, it's
talked about that.
Yeah. Jesse and Luke over at SFF Audio and Science Fiction Book Review Podcast had a discussion that was interesting, you know, and they were really talking about optimism throughout that whole thing.
Oh.
And
I haven't listened yet. I'll have to catch up on that.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting because, you know, Neal Stephenson and some others have said, you know, boy, we've gotten awfully dismal.
we really
ought to be more optimistic. And just yesterday on Twitter, I can't remember the author's name, but he was saying something like, I don't write optimistic fiction because all of this technology just, I'm trying to remember the exact word he used. It expands or magnifies humanity's natural tendencies. You know, so like Facebook and Twitter, you know, now I'm putting words in his mouth, but right. You know, Facebook and Twitter seem to be just magnifying the worst of ourselves. You know, we're now doing things on Facebook just to have things to post on Facebook.
Well,
you know what I mean?
But don't you think that, you know, it's, again, we look back at that older science fiction, and I'm older than you, so I can remember that feeling of, you know, if somebody came out with Tang, mm-hmm. for instance, my grandparents were like, this is so great. And they would serve it to us for breakfast. You're having the drink of the astronauts.
Yes, yes.
Pop-Tarts. Oh, Pop-Tarts and Tang for breakfast. We love visiting my grandparents, by the way, obviously. But it was this idea of they looked at everything that way. Wow, look, a new kind of this, a new kind of that. And they thought they probably could have agreed on it's expanding mankind's natural tendencies. But they would have said, we explore and find new things. It's almost like that Star Trek thing that we were talking about an episode or two ago, where it's they saw the good in mankind.
Yeah, exactly.
They saw the fact that the good can overcome the bad and help solve the bad. And how has it flipped now so that you think it's almost like, do you hate us? I mean, do we hate ourselves that all we see is the bad? Why do we not also see the wonderful stuff that happens?
Yeah, agreed.
That is going to happen.
100%, yeah. But and why can't we envision a place from here that is better than here? You know, all of that 1950s and 1940s science fiction, I think things really changed in the 60s in science fiction.
Yeah.
But in the 40s and 50s, everything that was, you know, most of what was being written was very positive and like, hey, look at what's possible and what, you know, where we might be headed. And, you know, isn't this amazing? And we're going to live on the moon, for heaven's sake. And it's going to be great.
Right.
You know, and there's all that stuff. You know, Star Trek is a perfect example because in the original Star Trek series, so many of humanity's petty problems are solved. They're not issues.
Yes, money. We don't worry about that.
Right. I mean, this is just not an issue. You know, we're out exploring and seeing new worlds and all this stuff. But all of this stuff that we deal with, you know, in this 1960s America are solved. And we're getting along with each other. Everything's fine. Now we're a team and we're meeting all this these other challenges, you know. But now, you know, like in the latest Star Trek movie, for example, we're kind of back to we've arrived at a pessimistic, you know, that's one thing that Luke said in that podcast is, why can't we have a government that's trustworthy, even in fiction?
Mm-hmm.
You know, wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to say or assume what his point is, but my point would be that should be a goal for us. And why not present that in a good light? And so, I mean, it's achievable. It's definitely an achievable goal.
And it's funny because people look at that and say, oh, you simple things.
Yeah.
You're so simple. Why should you expect a happy ending? That's just ridiculous. But they're also way out of balance. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's completely optimistic is ignoring the fact that you've got to keep an eye on things like Vish Puri does for the bad tendencies. But, you know, there's a marriage he investigates, or a pending marriage, where they feel like this guy cannot be as perfect as he seems. Well, it turns out he's just struggling with his own issues. He is actually a really great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it? And they're okay with that. They're like, okay, I'm not looking forward to this conversation with this grandfather who doesn't want this marriage to happen, but guess what? This is fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And why are we always looking for the bad, looking for what's going to go wrong? I mean, did we all get beat up too much when we were kids? Or because to aim for the stars is our best part of us. It's our heritage, really.
Yeah.
You know, in a Christian Catholic point of view, we are always seeking to become the best that we are, the best we can be. because we were made in the image of God. We should be creators. And is it, we're creators of good families. We're creators of businesses where we treat people fairly, even though they're only 4 employees. You know, we try to do the best thing. And yeah, you get disappointed. You have the employee who doesn't care. You have the employee who, you know, doesn't treat you well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm thinking of anyone in particular, of course. But you just keep trying because the good things are out there and they can happen, but nothing happens without work. And so why is it that we so easily accept this idea that, well, you're just stupid to think optimistically, to think the best can happen?
Yeah, yeah.
That's so defeatist, it is, and it's so minimalist, I feel.
It's incredibly cool timing, and this was not at all planned, but our next podcast is on Apollo 13.
Oh, right.
And talk about a reason for optimism.
I forgot.
Yeah, yeah. So exciting.
Yeah.
I'm super happy that's coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's funny because it seems to be a natural tendency, and I think I've read this before, for people to be negative.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I can see back in the caveman days, if you didn't keep an eye out, you were going to get eaten or something, or someone was going to take all your stuff.
In the words of Mr. Spock, it's always easier to destroy than to create.
Right.
You know, it's always easier not to do this than to work and make it better.
Right.
So.
And to be a gloomy Gus about it, just to use it, you know. But the thing that we're called to do is remember there is a higher purpose to our lives. We are noble by nature. We have to overcome the tendency to not be that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the Christian calling. If we're supposed to be like Christ, look at him. He gave up everything because of the people he loved. And he did it willingly, and he was happy to do it because that's how much he loves us. And that's what we would ideally do for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a noble thing, and that's worth being optimistic about. Why not work hard and try to do something great and uplifting?
Yeah.
Rather than go, well, we're all going to, you know, these people are horrible. I hate them.
Yeah.
Let's just assume they'll do the worst.
And there's a lot of that in the United States right now.
Yeah.
You know, I can't speak of India, but just saying, you know, in the United States, it's like every single issue, everybody takes sides, they put a label on it, and now it's, if you're conservative, you got to be talking this way, and if you're liberal, you got to be talking that way, and if you're in the middle somewhere, then, you know, you're of no use to anybody. It's just, it's gotten terrible.
Yeah, and as we know from emails, I can fall prey to that like anyone else. I had a very bad day earlier this week where I was just really suddenly hit by all that, and it's funny because the thing that kind of brought me out of it was just having a night with my book club. Mm. Now, there you're not going to find a more diverse group of people, even all Catholic ladies, but, you know, there's a lot of room for diversity. But it was being around all these other people who we all love each other because we've done this for so long. We were intensely interested by the book, which was G.K. Chesterton's, I think it used to be called The Dumb Ox. Now it's just called St. Thomas Aquinas.
Mm, yeah.
But in looking at St. Thomas as our example was really helpful for me and for several other people, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's so many examples in real life of reasons to be optimistic. And Thomas Aquinas' life is one of those.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a pretty rough beginning there, didn't he?
Well, yeah, the really wealthy family that was like, no, we've purchased the fact that you're going to be an abbot. Uh-huh. You're not allowed to be one of those begging priests. We're going to shut you up for a year and make you change your mind.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, and everybody made fun of him for being, you know, kind of a big, slow guy. No, he just
Which
didn't
is why he was the dumb ox, right?
And right.
Yeah, just, yeah. I love his story. I got to read that again.
Yeah, the fellow students would say, call him the dumb ox. And then finally his teacher, who later we call Albert the Great, said, you call him a dumb ox. I tell you, this dumb ox will let out a roar that will change the world or shake the world.
Yeah. And he did.
He's the one who showed, truth is truth. And all truth is God's truth. It all shows us another facet of God.
Yeah. So that kind of thing, you know, pulls me out of it too. When you start reading or talking about things that transcend all this garbage that's going on. And you're just like, oh, you know, now, even if you're talking with somebody who disagrees with the philosophy or whatever, when you're talking about that kind of stuff, it's like, oh, okay. You know, there's reason to be optimistic.
Yeah.
There's reason to feel good about the world. And,
yeah.
But exactly. You got to get above the mire and everybody's stuck in it. I mean, that's the way it just feels sometimes, is it?
No, yeah. I agree. So. And it's the one last thing that made me think of, because I was that day was just trying personally that way. And it made me think of Julian of Norwich, who not a lot is known of. She was a mystic in Britain, I believe, a long time ago. But she had a mystic vision, and basically what God told her, or what she came away with, was all is well, and all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And her vision was of God holding the world like a walnut in his hand. Hmm. It's like, you know what? It's all going to be all right.
Yeah.
You have to try your hardest, and things can get bad. And I think of what times were like for people personally, and how people will say that, even in the most terrible circumstances, like you'll find the happiest people in Africa sometimes, in much simpler societies where they may be struggling for lack of something, but inside they're happy. They understand the basic joys of life.
Mm.
And here we are, we're all removed from it. We've got an easier life than anyone in history has ever had, and we go around being all doom and gloom.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah,
I think that's what I liked about Vishpuri. You see all these substratas of Indian society, and he'll kind of go, oh, that's terrible, and we need to change it. But what he does is he does his stuff as well as he can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
that's what we do.
That's what we should be doing too,
right?
Yeah, we all have our own sphere of influence, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
If everyone does their best, you know,
yeah,
it's going to work out.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You help, for instance, he was thinking about this horrible court system, and he thought, well, my job is to get this litigator off because he's one of these great men who's going to truly be honest and try to change the system.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my contribution, and he didn't stop and worry about the rest of it.
Exactly,
so,
exactly, yep.
Yeah.
Yep, yep, yep.
Did you like the guys who, you kept finding new operatives that he had? And these two guys who were they on motorcycles that are following a suspect at one point?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's one guy who loves American movies and TV. And he's always talking like an American and using slang. But the other guy doesn't know what he means. So they're always having to stop and talk about what is it. And he says, Zia and Sashi were not far behind on an old Vespa. Someone else is following Bastard Number One, which is what they named this guy, said Zia. Roger that. Did you get a positive ID? Huh? Positive ID means, did you recognize him? How could I recognize him, you fool? He's got a helmet on and his number plate is covered in mud. 10-4, do you think he's a perp? Speak Hindi, would you? A perp means a gunda type. There's a glossary in back
for
words where you're like a gunda type. I mean,
I do.
Most
yeah.
of it from context.
There was another part where Handbrake, he drives Puri somewhere, mm-hmm. and Puri goes in there and he's having tea in this finest china. But Handbrake has to go park, you know, it's super hot. He has to go park somewhere. And he's having, it said something like he's having the same tea, but in this crushed paper cup.
Right.
Yeah.
While he squats under a tree with the flies and right. the other drivers
he's
or whatever.
Standing out there. Yeah. It's yeah. just something.
Yeah. And the.
But he, you know, he wasn't complaining, you know.
No.
Yep.
He was happy to have the steady job so he could send the money home for his
exactly.
wife and little girl.
Exactly right, yeah. Yep.
Puri had actually, he was a taxi driver, but he was under the most horrible circumstances. And Puri had used him and noticed his native intelligence and ability to really see and remember things. And he said, okay, you come work for me. And he gave him a very generous salary mm-hmm. and then started essentially training him just through conversation.
Yep.
So, and he doesn't make a big deal of it. This right. is just what he does.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? That's a good example.
And that's kind of, that's more helpful than when he's thinking about the Chancery Court, and the story you hear is just heartbreaking of the old farmer who's waiting for his trial to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks, well, I could give this man some money because for the price of a dinner here, we could solve his problem. And he says, but we need to solve the bigger problem. And that's when I was thinking, you could also give this one man his money and help him personally, mm-hmm. as well as helping the big case. You can't help everyone. But you were told this problem. You could help him and it wouldn't hurt you. And that would have been more my reaction.
Mm-hmm.
From a Christian point of view.
Sure.
We are called upon to do that.
Yep. Yeah, that's very true. Very true.
You need to teach people to fish, but you also sometimes they just need to be given the fish in the mean while they're learning or in the meantime. Exactly.
Yeah, just in the meantime, right?
Yeah, they still have to eat.
Heck yeah. So yeah, this book is full of that kind of stuff, and I really enjoyed it. So thanks for picking that one.
I'm so glad.
So there's three of these, actually. Again, the author is Tarquin Hall, and there's one called The Case of the Man Who Died Laughing, mm-hmm. and then there's one called The Case of the Deadly Butter Chicken. And coming soon, The Case of the Love Commandos.
Oh, well, and you know how it is with series. Sometimes you can read a few of them and then go, well, mm-hmm. it's too much the same, but
yep.
I did read the second one,
mm-hmm.
and I think I need to reread it. I remember, as I was telling you before, that the mystery seemed a bit far-fetched to me. Uh-huh. But I really enjoyed the further looks into Indian society because he looked at some other part of it. And in that sense, it makes me think of the Night Watch series, where every book, it furthers the overall plot, but you're seeing different parts of Moscow or Russian mm-hmm. life. And this one's the same. And that title about the case of the deadly butter chicken did make me feel like maybe I should revisit the series. That I really wanted to read that book.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's neat. Oh, good. I was thinking about other books that I've read in India, and I came up with one. There's one called The Song of Kali by Dan Simmons. And it won a World Fantasy Award a long time ago. But I read the book, and I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was terrific.
Right.
It was a long... Yeah, I wouldn't know... I don't know if I'd add it to
the
list.
You're not recommending it.
No. But it was a horror novel. Yeah, called The Song of Kali.
Kali.
One of Dan Simmons' early books.
And there's a book that I've tried a couple times and never been able to get into that Roger Zelazny, is that how you say his name, mm-hmm. wrote. And it is, I think, set in, if not India, with Indian-type gods that are actually real. And so it's from their point of view and...
Yeah,
I know in Chinese culture, there's an important monkey god, and I think there is in Indian culture,
isn't
too.
Isn't that Lord of Light?
That's it.
Yeah, and I have read that, and that's a super complex... Yeah, I enjoyed that book. It's been so long since I've read it, but it seems like that was set in the far future or something, but you're right, there were Indian gods and Kama Sutra or something like that.
Yeah, and it
no,
was...
that's not... That's right. Yeah.
Mahasamadman
or something like that. Yeah.
But it was difficult to get into.
Kama
and
Sutra,
at the time I was picking it up, I thought, you know what? I don't need to read that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't think I've really read many books about mm-hmm. India.
What about movies? Marigold Hotel is one that leaps to mind.
Yes.
Was it the best exotic Marigold Hotel?
That was a fine movie.
Yeah.
But the very best movie, one of my top 10 must-see desert island pool room movies is Monsoon Wedding.
Monsoon Wedding, which I have never seen.
It's on my list for us to watch sometime.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the few movies that every single person we've ever shown it to has absolutely loved it, no matter how diverse the people. And in fact, the last time we watched it was with a couple where the guy is rather difficult to please sometimes, or he doesn't always agree with us on movies for sure. And we got done and he said, that might be the best movie I've ever seen. Miranera made it, and she was in between filming. She was waiting for some movie to be approved that was having some contract negotiations or something. And she had just maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And she had the idea. They hurriedly wrote the script, shot it, and put it all together. And she did it as a tribute to her family. And it really shows, because it's about a large Indian family, that there's going to be an arranged marriage happening during monsoon season. And it starts off with you seeing them preparing for it. Everybody's coming together, coming from the airport. You see the contractor who's setting up the big tent and all these various things. You see the servants in the household. And it's told in this combination of the way, which I think is the way they talk, is, you know, a combination of what, Hindi and English. So at first it's a little difficult to get into because it's just all these little vignettes, but gradually they come together into this really marvelous story that just celebrates family. And you see a lot of, I think, upper middle class Indian culture in that. And fantastic. It's really, mm-hmm. It's really, really a wonderful movie.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm looking at it here on IMDb. That's neat.
Have you seen other Indian movies?
I'm trying to think of something.
Should I just keep going?
Yeah, then? Go right ahead. Huh?
Oh, well, because the ones I've seen are usually, you know, there's a very light, fluffy one that's enjoyable if you want just a taste of what a Bollywood movie is like. It's called Bride and Prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
By another Indian director, obviously made for Western audiences, but they take the Pride and Prejudice story, move it to India, and then tell it Bollywood style so that every so often everybody breaks into this glorious dance and just starts singing everywhere. And it's wonderful. It's just fun. And then another one that is unlikely, and I keep meaning to rewatch it, but I have to admit, it's got a 4-hour runtime, which is daunting. It's called Lagaan, Lagaan. And it is a true Indian Bollywood movie, but it's told in such a way that it's not inaccessible. Because we've tried a few of those, and we go, whoa, they did the caption so badly, I didn't, only when the person's talking do the words show up. And you're like, oh, I can't read that fast. And then things would happen, like somebody be in a bedroom singing and suddenly they're in the top of a tree and then they're waist deep in a pond. And we're like, we don't know. This is too different. We need more easing into the culture for this.
Yeah.
But Lagaan is not like that. It's actually a really intriguing story that is well told back in the days of the Raj, when there is a very cruel British ruler of this hill station who's making the village to go along with the Maharaja, he's making this village give an unreasonable amount of their grain as, you know, tribute.
Mm-hmm.
They have to fight back, and it winds up with this big cricket match. When we got done with that, we finally understood how cricket works.
Cool.
We got done with the first one, for the next one, and we went, what? We thought the movie was going to be done. And Tom's like, oh my gosh, this other disc isn't special effects, it's the other half of the movie. And we went, we're hooked, we have to watch it. And it was one of the greatest movies ever.
Cool.
Many songs, of course. And wonderful stylized dancing too.
Right.
So those are my three.
Yeah, I've seen Gandhi.
I've not seen that.
It's a very good movie, but you know, it's long.
I've meant to.
Yeah, it's good. What a man he was. Yeah, yeah. Very serious. Very good movie.
Yes, I have to be tricked into those movies usually.
Yep. So cool. Okay.
Yeah, I understand. World War Z may happen in India some. I know the book does.
Oh, does it?
Now you haven't read the book?
No, I have not.
Sir. I say again, sir, good day to you.
Should I do the audiobook?
Oh, yes.
Because I've heard it. Yeah, no, I remember you telling me that it's a remarkable audio. Tell me about
it. I reviewed it for SFF. I was so excited because I'd read the book and really loved it. And then I got the audio book, but it was abridged. And I said, why did they abridge this? Because it's told documentary style. It's somebody who, after they've overcome the zombie apocalypse, has gone around and done a UN report. And the way he did it had all these personal stories. And the UN said, we just want a report. Thanks. We don't need all these little stories. But why, you could turn it into a book. We give you permission. And so it's told as a string of firsthand interviews with everyone, tracing from the very beginning of the infections through all countries of the world, all kinds of societies, all sorts of people, down to here we are now. We've gotten over it. What have we learned? It's an amazing book. I've read it twice in print. And then recently, because the movie was coming out, Max Brooks finally strong-armed someone into doing what he always wanted to do, which is do the entire book in audio. And they've got all these voice actors, everybody doing the voices. It's amazing.
Oh, cool.
It's a supreme audiobook experience, I would say. Not that I'm too excited about it.
All right. Well, but I'm going to have to do that.
Yeah, but what's interesting about it is I was wondering how it would hold up in terms of being able to follow the story, and you just don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, even like Martin Scorsese does a character, Nathan Fillion. But you know, for me, the standout, one of the standout characters was Mark Hamill.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah. He does this kind of average level soldier, American soldier, and I hadn't realized how many times that soldier's voice is heard throughout the story, and he's perfect as just, you know, like the working class Joe who's a soldier telling his parts of the story. Every time he'd come up, I would get, oh good, it's him. I just liked how he told it.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, good. Okay, yeah, I've got a credit. And I'm looking at it. It's World War Z, the complete edition.
Mm-hmm.
A new recording of this, Yeah, an oral history of the zombie war featuring 21 additional Hollywood actors and sci-fi fan favorites performing stories not included in the original audiobook.
Right.
And that's the one to get. All right.
Oh, yeah. And
Simon Pegg. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. And he does an American. I'm like, what?
Oh, really?
You're doing an American? And he did really a fantastic job, except there was one place where a couple times in a row, I can't remember what word it was. It was something like out, and he just couldn't say it. That was the only tell I could see. The rest of it, I was surprised it was him.
Oh, that's
but,
cool.
But the thing I will say about World War Z, if anybody's interested in it but kind of worried about gore, is you don't really get those gory facts. The things that might make you wince a little are some of the realities. These are some of the darker things about humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that are done in order to protect everyone. But the thing is that Max Brooks is looking at a lot of things in this book. He is looking at government. He's looking at people. He's looking at the nobility of people. He's looking at the power of the media. He's looking at the wealthy versus the poor. He's looking at stereotypes. And I mean from all angles.
Hmm.
It's really, I mean, one of the most powerful stories is told by this guy who was a teenager and somebody who was a very militant believer in the fact that you've got to get the Jews out of Israel because his Arab people are never going to be free otherwise.
Hmm.
I guess he's Palestinian. They wind up having to go to Israel for protection, and that's when he sees people are people.
Well, I am
sold. And this
sold.
Government's yeah. not really out to get us. It's real. It's real.
That's amazing. I wonder if any of that's translated to the movie. I wonder how, you know, if it's good. I've heard that it's good. I've not seen it. I've heard that it's good.
I know. It's that thing of the only thing they have in common is the name, but it's still a great action movie is what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard anything much else because I think we're going to go see it.
Cool. That's great.
I'm curious to see what they do with it. Since I've heard it's a good action movie, I'm ready for that.
Great.
You know, Brad Pitt's fine. I approve of the fact that in the trailers I've seen wrinkles around his eyes. Thank you, Brad Pitt. You can let your hair not be blonde anymore. Let some gray through. We're fine with that.
You bet. All right. Okay, so yeah, we mentioned earlier that next up is Apollo 13.
Love that movie.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's terrific.
I've seen it four or five times.
Well, good. We'll see it one more time, huh?
Yeah.
And then after that, the book is Kirin Yaga by Mike Resnick.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a fun book to talk about. Lots to talk about in that book.
Is that a series of short stories?
It is. Yeah.
Been melded into a book or?
Okay. Yeah, but they're intact. Yeah, it is a series of short stories that are connected.
Okay. Yep. Well, like the Martian Chronicles.
Yeah,
or,
exactly.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
I always think it's interesting when an author is so attracted to his vision of a world that he keeps coming back to it, or that other people like it so much that they want him to explore it further, and where short stories will take you into all these different facets that probably reflect what the author's thinking at the time too, but that they're all connected into a whole. I love how that can really just be like a diamond, a cut diamond. Yeah. You know, you can look at all the different angles. So.
Yeah, almost every story in there has won an award of some type. Almost every single one.
Well, that's Mike Resnick's track record, right? Mm-hmm. He's a very well-known and honored author.
Yeah.
I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but what I've read, I've always liked. Mm-hmm. And I did get to read one of his stories for Escape Pod. So.
Oh, fantastic.
I know. I was so honored.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So. And what's after that? Ushpizin?
Ushpizin, I think is how you say it.
Okay.
It's an Israeli movie, and which I discovered through our friend Joseph Suzenka, who's been on here. He was on to talk about The Wrath of Khan. Wasn't that it? A group one we had.
Yeah.
And that's for our faith, our triannual faith emphasis. It's about a married couple during, I can't say it, Sukkot, a Jewish festival.
Okay, cool.
It's religious orientation, believe me.
Fantastic.
But it's lighter.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the book with the same kind of religious theme is The Hiding Place by Corrie ten Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's a more serious one that maybe a lot of people have read, but I, as an adult, was surprised. I listened to it. There was a free audio version from, I think it's, christianaudio.com is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And every month they have a free book. A lot of times I'm not interested, but this is an excellent reading. It's really highly recommended.
Fantastic.
And I was personally moved, of course, as anybody is. It's a story about the Holocaust, but a true story. But there were so many insights in there which I could apply to my own life, and I didn't remember that from reading it as, you know, in high school or whenever I picked it up because it was going around. So
cool. That's great. Well, okay. Well, that'll do it, I think, right?
I think so.
Okay. Well, thanks again for this book. I really enjoyed it.
And I
am going to read at least one of the other two.
Maybe both. I'm so glad. I'm going to reread that next one, I think.
Yeah, that's great.
Forge on.
I think these will be great audiobooks. I'm going to try the next one on audio. Should be fun listening.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned that.
A good book to listen to.
Great that way. I think you're right.
All three of them are available on Audible.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And I have my Audible membership.
Fantastic.
Yay.
And there was much rejoicing.
Yes. Yay. Or huzzah. I can't remember what they say.
Right.
We're going to have to watch a Monty Python movie sometime.
Yeah, sometime. Which one do we pick?
Oh, let me think. Not The Life of Brian. That's not the automatic one.
Yeah, that would be fun to talk about.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we will sometime.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And
yes.
We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.